You know you gotta do it.
Zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hey, and welcome to yet another edition of My Science Project. I am your host, Julia. And today's show is kind of a mishmash of science news and science stories that were quirky and interesting and fun, and I just thought deserved a mention on air. Among the things that we'll talk about today is how science can improve the earnings of sex trade workers, the truth about carbohydrates, as well as the link between obesity and global warming, and in fact, can drinking clean water kill you? We'll start the show off with a couple of weird, short, little quirky science tidbits. Have you heard of this animal called the chupacabra? This is something you might have seen on television in a Time Life book series where they're looking at, you know, the mystery animals of the world. And the chupacabra is this South American mythical creature that supposedly is this hairless dog-like thing that lurks and then will suck the blood of livestock and then slink back into the bushes. Very enigmatic sort of thing, apparently so, but science has, according to biologists at Texas State University, put the myth of the chupacabra to rest. There's a woman named Phyllis Canyon and some of her neighbors in San Antonio area who discovered the bodies of three animals over 4 days in July outside the ranch, and they look kind of like this chupacabra, hairless dog-like creatures. And what Phyllis Canyon did was thinking in a very practical way. She saved the head of one of these animals. So not only she could give the DNA to scientists to test to get to the bottom of what this creature was, but she also apparently wanted to mount it for her own memories. So biologists at Texas State U did a DNA sequencing of the tissue, and they found that it was a virtually identical match to DNA from a coyote. So it's more than likely that at least in Texas, the chupacabra is actually a coyote and not a mythical blood-sucking creature. Oh well. Another kind of weird science story that I thought was well worthy of mentioning on air was published in Current Biology recently in volume 17, October 2007, if you're interested in checking out the full paper. The title of this article by authors King, Douglas Hamilton, and Volrath is African Elephants Run from the Sound of Disturbed Bees. This isn't mentally disturbed bees, by the way. It's, you know, churn up the bees. Essentially, encroaching human development into former wildlife areas is compressing African elephants into even smaller home ranges than they already have. And this is causing increased levels of human-elephant conflict. African honeybees have been proposed as a possible deterrent to the elephants to remove them from areas where humans live. The authors found that a significant majority of elephants in a sample of 18 well-known families and subgroups of different sizes reacted negatively, that is, immediately walking or running away, when they heard the buzz of disturbed bees. However, they ignored the sound of white noise. Whether this observed response, whether the animals running and walking away from the bees, is the result of individual conditioning or of some kind of socially learned behavior has not been established by this paper, but this study strongly supports the hypothesis that bees, and maybe even this, just the sound of bees alone, can be deployed to keep elephants where humans would rather they be. Ha ha, Did you catch that pun? Bee? This is Why Does a Bee Buzz? Off the Singing Science Records.
If someone should ever ask you, why does a bee buzz? All you have to say is, did you ever hear a honeybee go buzz, 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 as it gaily wanders to and fro?
Did you ever hear a honeybee go as it gaily wanders to and fro? No matter where it's flying, in a garden or a town, 400 times a second, its wings go up and down.
Tiny wings vibrating make a humming sound and start the airwaves rushing to spread the sound around.
Did you ever hear a honeybee go as it gaily wanders to and fro?
Honeybees gather nectar and pollinate flowers and make honey. The honey is made in the honey stomach, found only in the workers. Hello, little honeybee. Goodbye, little honeybee.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Something dies, the FBI is there on the scene. The FBI is working overtime, the FBI, to pick those bones clean. Fungus, bacteria, invertebrates, the FBI. Fungus, bacteria, invertebrates, the FBI. There's fungus all among us and it's breaking things down. Billions of mycelium on the ground, that's why. When you hold a handful of the earth, you hold the FBI, whenever something dies, the FBI is there on the scene. The FBI is working overtime, the FBI, to pick those bones clean. Fungus, bacteria, invertebrates, the FBI, fungus.
And you're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Julia. And we just heard the song FBI, or Fungus Bacteria Invertebrates, by the Banana Slug String Band. If you're interested in this sort of music, you can go to the website, www.songsforteaching.com. Another interesting little tidbit that really has no rhyme or reason, but I thought was really funny, is a paper that was published in the journal Mycologist. This is a journal that focuses on the kingdom of the fungus. The authors are David Moore, Kelly Fryer, Charlotte Quinn, Stephanie Roberts, and Ruth Townley. And their article was called, How Much Are Your Children Taught About Fungi in School? This paper was published online just recently, but I think dates back to 2005. So I wonder, in the past 2 years, if they've made progress in this area of research, where they argue that although fungi are fundamentally important in our everyday lives, the kingdom is largely ignored by the national curriculum in the UK. They further argue that because of this, children are missing out on being taught about a crucially important group of organisms. Their paper describes a range of British Mycological Society learning resources designed to remedy this dire situation. covering a range of fungal topics, from cell structure and function through biotechnology to health topics and plant growth and disease, aimed to increase knowledge and awareness of fungi in an active and entertaining way, and thereby maintain interest in biology as a science. A very worthy cause, I think. And it raises an interesting point, actually, that I had a Czech colleague from the Czech Republic, and in their school system, the children are given a very rigorous section of the curriculum dedicated to identifying fungi. They actually have exams about what are edible fungi, what are poisonous, looking for mushrooms, this sort of thing. So other countries actually do give some time to the fungus. It seems in the UK, and I don't really remember much talk about fungus when I was going through school, but you know, that was eons ago, so that could have changed a lot. But it made me think, well, why would kids care to know about fungus? Why should we be teaching this? And in fact, fungus are really interesting. They're used for a huge range of purposes. Human use of fungus for food preparation or preservation and other purposes is extensive. It has a very long history. For example, yeasts required for fermentation of beer, wine, and bread, including pizza, good old pizza dough. And other fungal species are used to produce soy sauce and tempeh, two wonderful foodstuffs. Mushroom farming and gathering is a large industry in many countries. In a medical slant, many fungi are producers of antibiotics. These include beta-lactam antibiotics such as penicillin and cephalosporin. The widespread use of these antibiotics to treat bacterial diseases such as tuberculosis, syphilis, and leprosy began early in the 20th century, and they continue to play a part in antibacterial chemotherapy. Some fungus are capable of competing with or infecting other organisms that are considered beneficial for human use. For example, in agriculture, some fungi may be used to restrict or eliminate populations of harmful organisms like pest insects, mites, weeds, nematodes, and even other fungi, such as those that affect the growth or even kill the plants that farmers are trying to grow. So along with bacteria, another aspect of the fungus is that fungi are major decomposers of most terrestrial and even some aquatic ecosystems. So they play a critical role in the biogeochemical cycle. In other words, breaking things down so that nutrients go back into the food web and can be taken up by other organisms. So there you go. Who knew that fungus was so interesting, and that the kingdom should actually be taught to kids? The next suite of articles are kind of food-oriented. Again, interesting things that just kind of came through my inbox that I thought, what the heck? The first one is from Scientific American. It dates back actually to the summer, June 2007. And it's part of their segment of kind of weird science articles that they publish. And this one's called Strange But True, Drinking Too Much Water Can Kill. Apparently people can and do literally drink themselves to death, not with alcohol, but with water. We know, of course, that water makes up a huge proportion of the human body, about 66%. And we know, of course, throughout every day, water escapes our bodies through sweating, through going to the washroom, through breathing, among other routes. And so we need to constantly replenish the water that we lose. And of course, drinking too little water can be very dangerous, but drinking too much can also be dangerous. Apparently, earlier in 2007, a 28-year-old California woman died after she competed in a radio station's contest called Hold Your Wii for a Wii to win the Nintendo game console. And basically, she had 6 liters of water in 3 hours and then started to feel nauseous and vomited and eventually died from water intoxication. She's not the only person to have done this. In 2005, a fraternity hazing at the University California State University, actually resulted in the death of a 21-year-old man. He was forced to drink excessive amounts of water between rounds of push-ups in a cold basement. And the exercise component is actually important for why water, overdosing on water, can kill. There have been accounts of clubgoers who take a lot of ecstasy, they dance a lot, they dehydrate, and in an attempt to rehydrate, they actually overdose on water as well. And again, there's an activity component to why this happens. Lastly, a 2005 study in the New England Journal of Medicine found that close to 1/6 of marathon runners develop some degree of what they call hyponatremia, or dilution of the blood caused by drinking too much water. And essentially, hyponatremia means insufficient salt in the blood. And severe cases of hyponatremia can lead to this water intoxication, which, as I mentioned earlier, illness symptoms can include headache, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, frequent urination, and mental disorientation. Kind of similar in a way to what happens when you get too dehydrated. Essentially, what happens is when you drink a lot of water really quickly, your kidneys can't flush it out and your blood actually becomes waterlogged. This water has to go somewhere and it goes into the different cells of your body. Now, this usually isn't a big issue for cells in fatty tissues or muscle tissues because there's room for these cells to expand without really causing much harm, but it's not the case for the cells in your brain, specifically for neurons. This is because you have a really hard bony skull and it doesn't allow for a lot of tissue expansion. This is also why if you hit your head and you get swelling of the brain, it's really, really dangerous because there's just a bony wall against which the brain is expanding. So this swelling can be really disastrous, which is also referred to as a brain edema. It can manifest as seizures, coma, respiratory arrest, brainstem herniation, and ultimately death. Now, the plot thickens with this water intoxication when a few years ago, a kidney specialist named Heinz Valton from Dartmouth Medical School decided to test whether or not actually the common advice to drink 8 glasses of water a day was legit. And he did a huge review on this, and he didn't find any scientific studies to support this 8 ounces of water per day. And in fact, he determined that drinking that much water or more could be harmful, not only in terms of this hyponatremia and exposure to pollutants, but interestingly enough, and I've heard people say this, for making people feel guilty about not drinking, quote-unquote, enough water. If you're interested in reading this review, it was published in 2002 in the American Journal of Physiology. Apparently, no scientific studies after this 2002 review, according to Heinz Valton, have supported the 8x8 rule either. Now, it's not just a case of drinking too much water that kills. Joseph Verbalis, who's the chairman of medicine at Georgetown University Medical Center, says it's usually a combination of excessive fluid intake and increased secretion of vasopressin, which is an antidiuretic hormone. And this is where the exercise component that I mentioned earlier really comes into play. Vasopressin is made in the brain. It's secreted into the bloodstream. And basically, it tells the kidneys to save water. Its secretion increases in periods of physical stress, for example, in a marathon runner, and it can cause the body to conserve water even if the person is drinking to excessive quantities. So essentially, this vasopressin is prohibiting your body from getting rid of all the excess water that it really doesn't need and could cause it harm. So ultimately, if you're sweating, try and drink what you sweat and be careful. If you're doing extreme activities, marathon runners apparently are at a higher risk of actually overhydrating because they're losing so much water through sweat. Verbalis's advice ultimately for all those out there is drink to your thirst. Another story that I won't linger on because, God, the review is 17 pages long, but I think a lot of us have heard that garlic is good for us and onions are good for us for various reasons. There are reported effects for lowering cholesterol, for being active against developing fatty tissues, anti-diabetic properties, anti-thrombotic properties, antioxidant, antimicrobial, anti-carcinogenic, anti-mutagenic, anti-asthmatic, benefits of garlic and onion that actually promote your immune system. There's actually a huge list of pros that apparently onions and garlic have. So in this 17-page review that was published in Trends in Food Science and Technology in 2007, this was really recently, I just found it online actually, it's not even in hard copy yet, the authors Corzo Martinez, Corzo, and Villamiel did this huge review of all the literature and tackled each of these individual supposed benefits that onions and garlic provide. And interestingly, garlic and onions are from the same genus, Allium. Garlic is Allium sativum, and onion is Allium sepa. And their conclusions based on this huge literature review were that, in fact, there is good evidence that onions and garlic are good for you, not just because they make your food taste good, but because they do have a lot of really beneficial properties. They do note that you still need to, that scientists still need to test these to be absolutely sure of what they can do in humans versus most of the work which has been done on rodent models. They also mention in their conclusion something interesting, which is that, and again, this was done in rodents, so it needs to be tested in humans, but if you cook your garlic and onions at 100 degrees centigrade for 20 minutes, if you go over that, you start to lose the bioactive components. And in fact, if you're cooking onions and garlic 100 degrees centigrade for 40 to 60 minutes, only then do you get a really significant decrease. So if you're doing a quick kind of pasta sauce and you're frying up your onions and your garlic, you're going to be doing it at a lower temperature. It's great because you're getting all the good stuff that supposedly, according to a lot of scientific research, is there. Baking as well. You have to roast at 180 degrees for quite a while before you lose the properties. So, eat your garlic and onions. Carbohydrates have been a big issue of contention for over the past few years, especially in light of the Atkins diet, which essentially proposes that carbohydrates help you retain fat, prevent you from losing weight, and if you focus on a protein-based diet, weight loss will come much more easily for you and will be permanent. But there are a lot of problems, as a lot of us know, with the Atkins diet. It's something that scientists have looked at a lot. And in this context, it's very interesting that, in fact, the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has been meeting formally to discuss carbohydrates and their role in human health for decades now. Since the 1950s, the FAO and the HWO have regularly held joint expert meetings to review the state of scientific knowledge on the role of various nutrients in the human diet. And this included the Expert Meeting on Carbohydrates and Human Nutrition, which was held in Geneva in 1979. It was the first to focus on the topic of carbohydrates and aimed to review the role of carbohydrates as determinants of human health and disease. So they had this meeting and they talked about this, and they basically came away with the need to do greater reviews of the literature and the science behind it, and then they decided to meet. Almost 20 years later, in 1997, the joint FAO-HWO expert consultation on carbohydrates in human health was convened in Rome, where they talked about the science of carbohydrate digestion, the nutrients they provide, the ability for them to enhance physical performance, and to further the understanding of scientists with the role of carbohydrates with diseases such as obesity and even some forms of cancer. At this meeting in 1997, it was again confirmed as per the 1979 meeting, that carbohydrates are not only an energy source, but also have important impacts on the maintenance of human health. Okay, this is not a huge surprise to a lot of us. In early 2000, there were two other joint FAO-HWO meetings that looked at carbohydrates and their role in diet, nutrition, and the prevention of chronic disease. One of these was in Geneva. Another one was a technical workshop on food energy held in Rome. Essentially, these meetings addressed how industrialization, urbanization, economic development, and market globalization, lots of Asians in there, have resulted in rapid changes in dietary patterns described as, quote, nutrition transition, which reflects both quantitative and qualitative changes in diet, so how much people are eating and what they're eating. The adverse dietary changes include shifts in the structure of our diets towards a higher energy density of food, so we're eating higher calorie foods, with a greater role for fat and sugars in foods and greater saturated fat intake, mostly from animal sources. So we're eating sugary and more fatty foods. Reduced intakes of complex carbohydrates and dietary fiber, and reduced fruit and vegetable intake. Again, this is sort of stating what the rest of us informally know. We tend to snack on more refined, simple carbohydrate-based foods, and we tend to eat less fruit and veg and fresh foods. And included in there is the fiber and carbohydrates that are complex than we really should be eating. Now, this combined with a decline in energy expenditure, basically people are sitting on their butts a lot more these days, at least in Western societies, has significantly impacted the health and nutritional status of the population. Again, this is not really anything new. What's interesting about all this, though, I think, is that there are actually groups that are meeting in a formalized fashion that are engaging scientists. In fact, I think this panel involved 40 expert scientists in nutritional sciences to discuss this very thing and to get at the reality and the truth behind what I think has become a largely demonized food group, carbohydrates. Essentially, all of these, you know, eating more fatty, more refined foods and exercising less has contributed to the increasing burden of diet and nutrition-related non-communicable diseases, at least as it stands today. These include obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, stroke, and even some forms of cancer. So, although it might seem a bit silly to have a meeting about carbohydrates, the impact of how we eat them and how much we eat of them really has a huge impact on the health of people living, at least in Western societies. So, this was all published in the journal called the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition in 2007, very recently in Volume 61, Supplement 1, if you want to check it out. And there was specifically an article published, it was a review article by Dam and Seidel called Carbohydrate Intake and Obesity. And again, this may not come as news to you, but it's formalized in the scientific literature now that carbohydrates are, in fact, important, an important group of macronutrients that provide energy and can contribute to weight gain through excess energy intake. But in this review paper, Dam and Seidel concluded that there was no clear evidence that altering the proportion of total carbohydrates in your diet is an important determinant of energy intake. Translated into normal English, that means that if you follow the Atkins diet and you slice out carbs, it's not really necessarily impacting ultimately on how much energy you take in. Because if anyone's done the Atkins diet or known someone who has, you know, it's still a really high energy diet. You're taking up fat, you're taking up oils, you're taking up proteins. And if you translate this information to just a normal diet, I think essentially what they're saying is, If you're going to snack, make sure that you snack on some fruit, you snack on some veg, as well as some carbohydrates. But if you cut all of them out, you'll probably go into starvation mode and you'll overdose at some point, either on carbohydrates or on some other kind of food group. And let's not forget that carbohydrates doesn't just mean starch based foods. Carbohydrates include sugars, and sugars are found in fruits. They're found in vegetables. So it's actually really difficult to cut carbohydrates out from your diet completely and still maintain a really healthy diet that gives you all the nutrients and the minerals and the energy that you need to live your daily life. This paper also concluded that dietary fiber is associated with a lesser degree of weight gain in observational studies. So basically, up your fiber content, you'll feel full for longer, you'll tend not to snack more, and that if you eat whole grain cereals, vegetables, legumes, and fruit, this is a really great source for dietary carbohydrate intake. So if you want to get off the bread and the pasta and the rice, well, at least make sure that you get enough of your fruits, your veg, and try and get some whole grain unrefined foods in there too. Just a little tip from me to you. My Science Project, doing its part. In honor of carbohydrates, this is Bud the Spud.
Thank you so kindly. This here next song is about a guy that knows more about potatoes than anyone else in the world. It's Bud the Spud from the bright red nugget. Rolling on the highway, smiling. The spuds are big on the back of Bud's rig. The bump and sit good island. The bump and sit good island. From Charlotte down or from Summerside, they load him down for the big long ride. He jumps in the cab and he's off with the price of bagels. He's got to catch the boat to make Tormentine, and he hits up that old New Brunswick line. From Montreal he comes just a flying with another big load of potatoes. It's Bud the Spud from the bright red mud, rolling on a highway smiling. The spuds are big on a Mac of Bud's rig. The rum prints at Good Island. The rum prints at Good Island. Now the Ontario Provincial Police don't think much of Bud. Yeah, the cops have been looking for the son of a gun that's been ripping a tire off the 401. They know the name of the truck shines up in the sun. Green Gables. But he hits Toronto and it's 7 o'clock when he backs her up again the terminal dock, and the boys gather round just to hear him talk about another big load of potatoes. It's Bud the Spud from the bright red mud, rolling down a highway smiling. The spuds are big on the back of Bud's rig. The bum prints at Good Island. The bum prints at Good Island. Ah, play it, Billy Boy. From east to west, that like the spuds from the island best, cause they'll stand up to the hardest test. Bread on the table. So when you see that big truck rolling by, wave your hand or kind of wink your eye, cause that's Bud the Spud from old PEI. Well, big load of potatoes. It's Bud the Spud from the bright red mud, going down a highway smiling. Because he's got another big load. The best doggone potatoes that's ever been growed. And our plump and Sitford Island, the plump and Sitford Island.
Holy smokes, I can't believe I'm part of the coolest club in the world.
Bub?
Yeah?
So, what club is that?
CITR. As a club member, I get ginormous discounts on the Friends of CITR card, which in itself, Timmy, I must say, is pretty amazing. I get dirt cheap prices at stores and shops I'm at all the time anyway. To be honest, it feels like being in a club within a club.
Wow. Hey, I want a Friends of CITR card.
You don't even have to be a member to get one, although clearly you'd be that much cooler if you were a member. Go purchase your Friends of CITR card down at CITR, or at special events they sponsor, such as concerts, membership drives, and shindig.
I got it. It feels like having special powers. I go into stores and bam! Discounts.
Tis what I said.
You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Julia, and the show is looking at kind of weird and quirky science stories that have come across my desk of late. One of those is something that is related to the last story to do with carbohydrates. This came out in the Canadian Press November 11th of this year, making a link. It's not the first time this link has been made at all, but I think we're getting into the popularization of this information that global warming and obesity are somehow linked. Apparently, according to one number-crunching scientist, if all Americans between the ages of 10 and 74 years walk just half an hour a day instead of driving, they would cut the annual U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide, which is the chief greenhouse gas, by 58 million tons. This would also save about 25 billion liters of gasoline. And ultimately, Americans between the ages of 10 and 74 who walked for just a half hour a day would also shed, in total, more than 3 billion pounds. Because of these hard numbers, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the U.S. is considering public promotion of the, quote, co-benefits of fighting global warming and obesity-related illness through everyday exercise, such as walking into school or to work. The World Health Organization estimates that 160,000 people died in the year 2000 from malaria, diarrhea, malnutrition, and even drowning from floods that they say are really the product of global warming in some way, shape, or form. So essentially, the key here, this link between obesity and global warming, is to get people, first of all, away from their car. So this not only would help curb obesity and cut greenhouse gases, it would mean, according to scientists at the International Association for Ecology and Health, cutting down pollution, resulting in fewer deaths from car crashes, although more cyclists and pedestrians might get hit by cars, I don't know. It would lower the rate of osteoporosis because walking is a resistance exercise that helps to strengthen bones. And because exercise is linked with feel-good chemicals in the brain, it would also help to alleviate depression in a lot of people. There was a paper published in 2005 by a scientist and policy fellow with the American Meteorological Society named Paul Higgins, who calculated the specific savings from adopting the half-hour-a-day recommendation would mean that the average person would lose 13 pounds a year. And if everyone did that, the United States would burn a total of 10.5 trillion calories. Now, it's not just the exercise and the cutting back on driving that's important. It's also food intake. At the John Hopkins School of Public Health, Dr. Robert Lawrence suggests that a shift away from heavy meat consumption would also help lower greenhouse gas production because much more energy and land use is required to grow up meat than it is fruits, veg, and grains. In fact, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization reported in 2006 that the meat sector of the global economy is responsible for 18% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. So, basically, the average American man eats 1.6 times as much meat as the government recommends, and there is some evidence linking red meat consumption with colon cancer. All of this basically suggests that the impact of driving everywhere and eating lots of meat is really serious. This also applies to us, too. Of course, Americans aren't the only ones who do a lot of driving and a lot of meat consumption and cut down on their exercise when they should be getting out there and doing more. So in Canada, we could, I'm sure, stand to follow these guidelines as well. This is Morrissey with America is Not the World.
America, your head's too big, because
America's America. Your belly is too big, and I love you, I just wish you'd stay where you is. Oh, 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 in America, the land of the free, they said, of opportunity in a just and a truthful way. But where the president is never black, female or gay, and until that day you've got nothing to say to me to help me believe. Oh, 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 in America, it brought you the hamburger. Oh, well, America, you know where you can shove your hamburger. And don't you wonder why in Estonia with no warmth within, greets the world. And I have got nothing to offer you. No, 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 no. Just this heart deep and you don't need. See with your eyes, touch with your hands, please. Hear through your ears, know in your soul.
I guess you could title this next segment Science and the Sex Trade, because there's a couple of stories that are about how science is actually studying various aspects of human sexuality and how people profit from that in different ways, and developing technologies that can actually make life a bit safer for sex trade workers, or more profitable in the case of the first story. This was a paper that was published back in, I think, the fall of this year, in Evolution and Human Behavior, Volume 28, in case you want to look this one up. The authors are Miller, Tiber, and Jordan, and it's essentially studying, as the title says, ovulatory cycle effects on tip earnings by lap dancers, economic evidence for human estrus. Essentially, estrus is a phase of increased female sexual receptivity, proceptivity, selectivity, and attractiveness. It's when, as you probably well know, women are able to conceive. And this is something that's found in primates, all of us, of which we are part of that group. Now, conventional wisdom holds that human female estrus has become uniquely lost or hidden over evolutionary time. So we're unique among primates in that we've covered up our estrus cycle, maybe to promote male provisioning and paternal care in long-term pair-bonded relationships. So if the man never knows when you're in estrus, then he doesn't know sort of when to slack off and when to pay attention. So he's going to be invested 100% of the time. So the question here was actually, is this true? Is estrus in human females lost or hidden? There are some previous studies that actually suggest that men, human males, are sensitive to estrus cues in real-world situations. So even if estrus isn't overt, let's say through ischial scrags and baboons turning all kinds of funky colors, or you get pubic swellings in chimpanzees, even if human females don't have these colorful displays of receptivity, it could be that males are still picking up on the fact that they're going into estrus. So what the researchers did here was they studied a group of 18 lap dancers in Albuquerque, of all places, in gentlemen's clubs. In 2006 and 2007, these dancers performed topless but not bottomless, so it's possible for dancers to work while menstruating because that's not visible if they choose to wear a tampon. Dancers maximize their earnings by providing as many lap dances as possible per shift and get tips per lap dance. Patrons assess the lap dancers based on the relative attractiveness of the different women. And so they sometimes sample a few lap dances before settling on lap dances from different women before settling on the woman who they'd like to get a consecutive series of lap dances from. Now what they did was they got the women to log, using a website that they created, their menstrual cycles, essentially. And they had women who were both on a contraceptive pill, and so artificially regulating the menstrual cycle, or women who were not using contraception of that nature, and so they were cycling naturally. They found strong ovulatory cycle effects on tip earnings in these lap dancers that were moderated by whether the participants were normally cycling. All women made less money during their menstrual periods whether they were on the pill or not. However, normally cycling women made much more money during estrus, about $354 US per shift, which was about $90 US more than during the luteal phase and about $170 US more than during the menstrual phase. So they made more money when they were essentially ready to fertilize, I guess. Estrus women made about $70 per hour, luteal women made about $50 per hour, and menstruating women made about $35 per hour. So a definite decrease in earnings depending upon how far they were from estrus. In contrast, lap dancers who were on the pill had no mid-cycle peak in tip earnings because they really had no cycle per se, because the pill eliminates peak fertility effects on the female body and behavior, essentially by putting the woman in a state of hormonal pseudo-pregnancy. However, this also resulted in pill users making only $193 US per shift compared to the normally cycling lap dancers who made about $276 per shift. So women who were on the pill who did the lap dancing lost more than $80 US per shift compared to the women who cycled naturally. Now, it's possible with the interaction between the men and women, particularly if men are sampling different lap dancers, that there are signals or cues that are leaked somehow between the females and the males that the men are picking up on. It could be that men are opting to get lap dances from women who are in estrus versus those who are in luteal or menstrual phase or who are on the pill, full stop, which is really interesting. So if you happen to be a sex trade worker, or you know someone who is, or if it's a career choice you're considering, the science, the study, you know, it points out it's not perfect, and it did have a small sample of 18 lap dancers, but apparently if you choose to cycle naturally, you'll bring more money in. Another science story that is related again to sex workers is GPS alarm shoes. Some bright spark has actually come up with a special shoe designed for streetwalkers to help them stay safe. It's a platform shoe. It's a little conspicuous looking. This is from Wired.com. It has a built-in audible alarm to scare off attackers. And when the alarm is triggered, the prostitute's position is transmitted to either the police in cities where prostitution is legal or to sex workers' rights groups. The GPS unit uses amateur radio frequencies to send the data. Unfortunately, the shoes are only a concept at the moment, although they are a working concept. Ideally, men's and women's sizes will be made available and orders will be taken for custom builds. Having said all that, this is Edwin Starr's 25 Miles, and if we have time for it, we will sag into Parliament's Agony of Defeat in honor of funky shoes everywhere. This has been My Science Project. I have been your host, Julia. Up next is Stereoscopic Readout, a very cool show. And in 2 weeks' time, my co-host Anne will be taking to the airwaves to bring you the next edition of this show. If you'd like to get in touch with Anne or myself, email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. That's myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. Thank you for listening. Take care. Have a great weekend.
yourself a dish of some kind. Get up every day.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
fun.
While
fun
cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains
fun. Fun
devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet
fun
doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed. But a word of caution, handle it with care and don't drop your guard. This rapacious new breed prowls both alone and in packs, operating at any level, any time, anywhere, and with anybody. Who are they?
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.